most lethal terrorist organizations in the world.
As the US and Taliban and Afghan authorities are moving closer to a final accord, the Daesh upsurge in Afghanistan is picking up momentum. The Takfiri group has called on all its followers to renew their allegiances and is also set to absorb thousands of Taliban members who wish to continue to fight for reasons of ideology, employment, profit, and tribal enmity. There are some 20 other terrorist groups of various nationalities that have been battling Afghan and US coalition forces beside the Taliban for years. None of them are anyhow included in the deal with the US. Daesh Khorasan has already established ties with most of these groups, and fostering such alliances would only accelerate once the deal is finalized. Daesh Khorasan has already established ties with most of these groups, and fostering such alliances would only accelerate once the deal is finalized. Daesh is building up its power with patience and persistence to set the stage for a Takfiri takeover, while uncertainties about the future of the country's security following the withdrawal of US troops are further bogging down Afghanistan in a quagmire of interlocking forces.
Now it's time to bring in our next guest, Mr. Tim Anderson. He's the director of the Center for Hegemonic Studies. Mr. Anderson, welcome to the show. So, what are the reasons behind the increasing Takfiri terrorist attacks in Afghanistan?
I think there's two reasons. One is that the US, when it withdraws, and it will withdraw, wants to maintain some measure of instability in the country and in that part of the region. So that there is not a re-establishment of a stable, independent state there, which runs contrary to their plans. It's also important to remember, I think, that Afghanistan is one of the countries that surrounds Iran. So to have assets in the form of Takfiri terrorists on the borders of Iran, on both sides of the borders of Iran, surrounding it, is something that the US wants to try and keep a presence and a pressure on Iran to try and contain the influence of Iran in the region. They have been relocating these groups from Syria and Iraq as they were defeated various times in at least relocating the commanders, those with experience, that is to say those with many years of experience, sometimes from Chechnya and other parts of the world, but particularly after the elimination of the groups in Iraq and Syria, they have been moving their assets across to the other side of Iran, to Afghanistan.
All right, so the US wants to maintain instability in the region and keep check on Iran at the same time. How can Afghanistan contain the Takfiri terrorism in the country, especially following the withdrawal of the US military? Of course, if it ever happens.
Well, I believe it will happen. They have been there 19 years now. I think they are going to withdraw. And as they withdraw and when they withdraw, I think that the terrorist issue will be reduced substantially. Really, these groups, as we see in Syria at the moment, they require a safe haven. They require a sponsor. Now, it may be that they are getting assistance in Afghanistan and from the Saudis to some extent, but the principal safe haven, for example, in Syria is the presence of US troops, of Turkish troops and Israeli troops on Syrian soil. That's where the safe havens for all the terrorist groups are there. So I think as the US withdraws from Afghanistan, that issue of groups of Daesh or whatever they want to call themselves in Afghanistan will be dealt with relatively quickly.
All right, you think it will happen and terrorism will reduce when it does? So, before asking the next questions, let's see the media views regarding this problem.
The Afghan government alleges that the so-called Khorasan province of the self-declared caliphate, known as ISIL-K, the outfit responsible for the prison break in Jalalabad and a series of others throughout Afghanistan, is basically acting as a front group for the Taliban. They argue that the Taliban, and specifically the Haqqani network, an integral part of the Taliban's command structure, is using ISIL-K as a cutout for operations it doesn't want to be held responsible for conducting. This includes certain attacks targeting civilians, as well as operations that may appear to violate the spirit of the deal between the US and the Taliban. Select analysts worry about a potential resurgence of Daesh within this camp. Some see it resurging as a result of organic factors, such as the history and appeal of Salafism in Kunar and Nangarhar provinces. They also warn that Afghan state practices of repression, exclusion, and bribery redispose some youth, specifically those sympathetic to Salafist ideological precepts, toward the ISIL.
Mr. Anderson, the U.S. is in open talks with the Taliban after two decades of war. What is your reading of this? Doesn't this embolden or encourage other terrorist groups to establish more power?
Well, whatever you think of the Taliban, they are an indigenous group created in the circumstances of Afghanistan of the last few decades. And it's the case that the occupying powers, the invading powers, always at some stage have to talk to the resistance, to the local, to the indigenous resistance at some stage. When they can't achieve the goals of eliminating them or marginalizing them completely, they haven't been able to eliminate the Taliban. The Taliban has shown extraordinary resilience, and this is not whether you agree with their ideology or their approach or anything, but they have maintained an incredible resistance within their own country. And the US is trying to find some way to extract itself there. Preferably, they would prefer to leave a destabilized country with pockets of Daesh in there, for example, because Afghanistan is part of a region which the US is very reluctant to give up. But eventually, they will have to leave, and they will have to leave through talks or leave with their tails between their legs. And so I think they have been looking for some opportunities to withdraw and save some sort of face and pretend that they had not been an illegal occupying power, brutalizing and slaughtering the people of Afghanistan for the last two decades. If they can do that with some sort of agreement, then I think they might prefer to do that. But it's a slow process because, as we've seen in all the other parts of the region, even when the US suffers a defeat, it doesn't really know how to accept losses very well. It's a bitter pill, and they are constantly looking for some sort of opportunity to withdraw and pretend that they had not been the terrible, destabilizing, brutalizing force that they actually are.
All right, either talks or tail between the legs. Fair enough. And that was our episode covering the issue of the presence of ISIS in Afghanistan and its challenges. We'll meet next week.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
The U.S. health and economy are going backwards, not forwards, because Republicans and the leader of their party have spent months doing the very opposite of what is needed, says Jake Johnson Ryder in an article published under the heading, Deeply Disturbing Surge in Layoffs Spotlights Cruelty of Trump GOP Refusal to boost unemployment benefits. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. Hours after the U.S. reported a staggering 3,000 coronavirus deaths in just 24 hours, the Department of Labor announced on Thursday, December 10th, that an additional 1.3 million Americans filed jobless claims last week, further bolstering the case for a bold relief package and spotlighting the cruelty of the Republican leadership's continued opposition to boosting unemployment benefits. According to the latest figures from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, nearly 20 million Americans are currently receiving jobless benefits just over 2 weeks before funding is set to expire for a pair of key emergency unemployment insurance, UI programs, a lapse that would hurl millions of people off a benefit cliff. The 1.3 million who applied for UI last week was an increase of 276,000 from the prior week, bringing initial claims back to their highest point since September. Heidi Scherholz, senior economist and director of policy at the Economic Policy Institute, wrote in a blog post recently. Further, last week's increase was not just due to week-to-week volatility in the data. The four-week moving average of total initial claims is now at its highest point since October. In other words, Scherholz added, layoffs appear to be rising, consistent with the resurgent virus. Faced with worsening economic metrics and widespread suffering, evidenced by miles-long food lines, overwhelmed unemployment systems, and a looming tsunami of evictions, the Trump administration and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell are hawking relief plans that would not increase weekly unemployment benefits at all. Additionally, according to the Washington Post, the White House plan does not appear to extend the number of weeks people are eligible to be on unemployment programs, an omission that would leave the millions of Americans who have already exhausted their benefits with no lifeline. Representative Don Beyer, incoming chair of the Congressional Joint Economic Committee, called the latest layoff figures deeply disturbing and slammed Republican lawmakers for attempting to penny-pinch the American people during a pandemic. If Republicans refusing to extend unemployment benefits and other forms of relief are not convinced by the most recent unemployment numbers, 19 million drawing unemployment benefits, 3.9 million long-term unemployed, 38 straight weeks of weekly unemployment claims greater than the worst week of the Great Recession, then nothing will convince them, said Beyer. The nation's health and economy are going backwards, not forwards, Beyer continued.
because Republicans and the leader of their party have spent months doing the very opposite of what is needed to contain the coronavirus and responsibly rebuild and recover from this recession. In the place of a weekly UI boost, the White House has offered direct stimulus payments of $600 per adult and $600 per child, well short of the progressive call for $1,200 per adult and $500 per child on top of extra unemployment benefits. McConnell's plan would not provide any direct payments or aid to state and local governments, which economists say is desperately needed. Speaking to reporters on Wednesday, December 8th, as relief talks appeared on the verge of collapsing once again, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, the administration's lead negotiator, insisted that the White House's stimulus checks would be more beneficial than an increase in weekly unemployment payments. But as the Post's Jeff Stein and Mike DeBonis noted, compared to the White House's call for one-time payments of $600 per person, jobless Americans would receive at least an additional $4,800 for each unemployed worker if weekly UI payments are increased by $300, as proposed by a bipartisan relief measure. Jeremy Fung, spokesperson for government watchdog group Accountable.us, said in a statement recently that with rising levels of food insecurity and a new wave of evictions in less than 1 month, the Trump administration should be working around the clock to get relief into American pockets. Instead, Mnuchin and the White House think now is a good time to propose gutting jobless benefits and cutting stimulus checks in half, the last thing vulnerable Americans need in this recession, Funk added. Congress and the Trump administration's priorities must be on containing the virus and getting relief into the hands of the millions of workers and thousands of small businesses that desperately need help. Unlike the plans offered by McConnell and Trump, the bipartisan coronavirus relief proposal currently being fleshed out on Capitol Hill would extend pandemic unemployment programs at 16 weeks of benefits and provide a $300 boost to weekly UI payments. But that proposal would not provide any direct stimulus payments, a popular form of relief that progressives are demanding as an essential component of any relief package, in addition to a weekly UI supplement. In a statement recently, People's Action Executive Director George Goel said, "It is unconscionable that we have COVID relief proposals on the table that deny people direct cash assistance and offer corporations a get-out-of-jail-free card for consequences of forcing employees to work in dangerous conditions." Mitch McConnell and Senate Republicans blocked relief bills for months as 284,000 people died and millions suffered under an economic crisis, said Gall. A bill that doesn't include cash assistance fails to deliver on the most simple and direct means of providing short-term relief.
Following his capture by Iranian intelligence agencies, Rual Azam was brought to trial and executed for his management of the Ahmad news page on the Telegram application, a page that encouraged people in Iran to commit acts of crime against public infrastructure, institutions, and authorities. As a result, France, Germany, Italy, and Austria have all condemned the execution of Zam, and as an act of protest, have pulled out of an online business forum in Tehran, leaving the organisers of the event forced to postpone to a future date. Some of the items on the page administered by Zam included the incitement of terrorist acts in Iran, involving the building and use of petrol bombs, as well as actively guiding people when and where to protest, ensuring maximum attendance during the crime sprees fueled by Zam's instructions. Said Khatibzadeh, the spokesman for the Iranian Ministry of Foreign Affairs, has claimed that the statements and speculative comments delivered by the EU nations was hypocritical and devoid of any value, clearly showing that they were either ignorant to the facts or were simply choosing to ignore them. In response to the act, the Iranian Ministry of Foreign Affairs has also summoned the German and French ambassadors to the MFA in order to present representations to the heads of missions, an act that demonstrates a clear message in diplomatic terms as to the gravity of the situation. So with Iran labelling Zam as a terrorist, why then has France, Germany and other EU nations sympathised with such a person, in particular when they were so aware of the true actions committed by Zam and his so-called news channel?
I believe that it's not difficult to show that principles of the European countries when crystallize themselves into a concrete political form, they become tainted with self-interest and hypocrisy. Speaking of moderation, however, where an official and a scientist in the Islamic Republic of Iran is assassinated by terrorist elements and then condemning punishment of a rebel and not journalist vowed to undermine Iran's national security is far from hypocrisy. Western countries' intelligence, media, financial, and diplomatic support of rebels whose goal is set for them to turn a country into rubble, to subvert a nation, is shameful and I think must be confronted.
What now remains to be seen is whether the EU will apply this logic across a broader screen and condemn the assassinations of senior Iranian figures by other nations, which again demonstrate more traits of terrorism against Iran that conveniently seem to be treated with silence. The Telegram application is like many other forms of social media, a tool that's used to send and share information around the world with friends, family and others. Although Zam's Ahmad News had over 1 million followers at its peak, it's unfair to label the channel as a media outlet. It's hence interesting to question the EU labelling Zam as a journalist, when in all reality he was nothing more than a tool of coercion, acting as an agent provocateur on behalf of various intelligence agencies. It also raises the question as to why the term journalist was used for a man who worked in liaison with the DGSE in France and Mossad, and openly bragged that after Emmanuel Macron, he enjoyed the highest levels of state protection in France, conditions which seem a little odd for just a journalist. Furthermore, why were the French so happy to host Zam, who, like the terrorist cult, the MEK, enjoyed the comfort and protection of living in France, in spite of being involved in heinous crimes, and accepted as a terrorist organisation by many nations around the world?
Well, he is not a journalist. What's important here, I think Iran has learned its lesson. Today, 17,000 Iranian officials and people have fallen prey to assassinations and terrorist acts of MEK that have extensive support of diplomatically and financially from Western countries.
With the EU sitting on the fence with Iran across a host of issues, in particular when it comes to the JCPOA, is now not the time for the powers of Europe to recognise Iran's inalienable right to protect its national security interests, just as each European state does on its own, and at the same time show some level of consistency when it comes to recognising other people and groups like Ruhollah Zam and the MEK, and concentrate less on the irrelevant non-state actors, condone the state-sponsored assassinations, and build a level and safe playing field for all.
Supporters of U.S. President Donald Trump protesting the outcome of the last month's presidential election
clashed with counter-protesters in the U.S. capital, Washington, D.C. Police used pepper spray to break up the brawls that erupted between Trump's fervent supporters, Proud Boys, and Antifa counter-protesters. Four people who had sustained potentially life-threatening stab wounds were taken to hospital. Police also said 23 people were arrested.
There's a famous saying that during times of crises like this is when fascism starts to rise. And that's what we're seeing in the United States. We're seeing the rise of a far right, a very Islamophobic far right as well, that is anti-immigrant, that has hatred for people from the global south, that want to reclaim the United States as a white settler colonial state versus everyone else. Because Trump is no longer part of the equation, this right-wing radical base is becoming more violent, more of a threat, and people really need to be careful, because during times like this of crisis, we saw it happen in Germany, and you know, we're seeing something very similar in the United States.
The far-right supporters also rallied outside the U.S. Supreme Court, where retired Army General Mike Flynn delivered a speech. Flynn, who served as Trump's national security advisor for a brief period, was recently pardoned by the president after pleading guilty to lying to federal investigators during a probe into Russian meddling in the 2016 presidential election. Donald Trump cheered on the protesters. In a post on his Twitter account, the president celebrated the demonstration, which was a follow-up to the last month's much-publicized Stop the Steal rally. Those rallies also ended in violence, with pro-Trump and counter-protesters engaging in fights that left multiple people injured, including four police officers. The Proud Boys is a self-proclaimed Western chauvinist group whose ideology has been labeled as misogynistic, Islamophobic, and anti-immigration. Trump made controversy during presidential debates when he refused to condemn white supremacists, urging the far-right group to stand back and stand down.
I'm willing to do anything. I want to see peace.
Then do it, sir.
Say it. You want to call them? What do you want to call them? Give me a name.
White supremacists and right
Boys. Who would you like me to condemn?
White supremacists and right
Proud Boys. Stand back and stand by.
The group has claimed its members, usually carrying weapons and military gear, only use violence in self-defense. But some of the group members have been convicted of committing violent crimes against counter-protesters. Donald Trump is continuing his attempts to maintain power, even though federal authorities greenlit U.S. President-elect Biden's transition late last month. His refusal to concede has fueled angry demonstrations by his most loyal supporters, drawing fierce opposition against the Democrats. This is expected to complicate matters for President-elect Joe Biden, who vowed to, quote, heal the divided U.S.
I think the fact that there's so much chaos going on in the United States right now, I think that Trump doesn't really care about the lives of innocent people. He doesn't care about the lives of the average working class person in the United States. What he cares about is fulfilling the interest of his lobby that helped him get elected into office. We're talking about the prison industrial complex, the military industrial complex, Israel, a lot of Zionists who are pushing all they can to escalate war against Iran right now.
Donald Trump took up office with his signature motto of making America great again. 4 years on, the United States seems far from what Trump claimed to achieve.
On Thursday, Morocco joined the list of Arab nations that normalized relations with Israel. The U.S. President Donald Trump announced the news on his Twitter page. He said the two sides decided to start full diplomatic relations. Morocco was among those countries that never had official ties with Israel since its occupation of Palestine in 1948. But in unofficial levels, the two sides have always shared relations and intelligence. In 1993, after Israel and the Palestinian Liberation Organization signed the Oslo Accord, Rabat and Tel Aviv began a series of low-level ties. But Morocco suspended the relations after the outbreak of the Second Palestinian Intifada in the year 2000. That is why Rabat now called the normalization deal a resumption of diplomatic relations. Several reports by Moroccan media indicate that King Mohammed VI has sought to restore ties with Israel in recent years. But the government has denied or remained silent about such news.
The normalization between Israel and all the Arab and Muslim countries is really nothing new, at the exception of that this normalization is coming out to light. All these countries have never declared war on Israel and enjoyed excellent ties with the Israelis. Therefore, the only difference today is just this relationship is overt. So we're learning about it, about the exchange of diplomatic and normalization between Israel and these countries. It's just a mere propaganda and an advertisement for Netanyahu to boost his image domestically because of his domestic troubles at home.
Morocco agreed to this rapprochement in return for American recognition of the kingdom's claim over the long-disputed territory of the Western Sahara region. In February, Israeli media reported that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had lobbied the U.S. to recognize Moroccan sovereignty over the Western Sahara in exchange for the deal. Such a move gave Morocco what it has for long wanted, but it also undercuts an independent movement in the Western Sahara region, which has rejected Morocco's claims of sovereignty. The Polisario Front, an independent movement from Western Sahara, slammed the U.S. move and said it highly regrets Trump's decision. But the people of Western Sahara are not the only ones who are angry at the U.S. and Morocco. Palestinians have denounced the agreement also. The Palestine Liberation Organization said Morocco's decision was unacceptable. The resistance movement Hamas said that Israel uses every new normalization deal to increase its aggression against Palestinians. Morocco's royal court said that King Mohammed VI had called Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and reiterated his commitment to the rights of Palestinians to have their own state. But it seems that Palestine has a hard time to believe the king. Behind the news that Israel and Morocco will establish the first formal diplomatic relationship, there lies almost six decades of close, secret cooperation on intelligence and military matters. Israel has helped Morocco obtain weapons and intelligence gathering gear and learn how to use them. Tel Aviv also helped Rabat to assassinate an opposition leader. In return, Morocco has helped Israel in matters like spying on other Arab countries. The two sides have had no problems contacting each other. The only thing they needed was a broker. The U.S. made that deal happen, and in the meantime, struck a deal for itself. Following the announcement, the administration of Trump has moved forward with a major arms sale to Morocco. The package is worth $1 billion and includes drones and precision-guided weapons. The White House has reportedly sent a notice to Congress about the potential deal.
We saw with the United Arab Emirates that the Americans promised to sell the F-35 and still didn't manage to get this deal off because the Israelis are blocking it and imposing specific conditions to keep the superiority over any other country. Therefore, with Morocco wants some armed drone. Actually, it could have bought these armed drones from Turkey, and Turkey is supplying European countries and the international market with its most advanced drone, particularly after the last battle that its drone went through in Azerbaijan-Armenian conflict. I don't think it is the sale of arms that is attracting Morocco. I think it's a pressure from Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who wants to gather as many countries, Islamic and Arab countries as possible before he moves in, and for Saudi Arabia to announce its official normalization with Israel.
This would be among the first drone sales under the Trump administration. Morocco is the latest country to agree to normalize relations with Israel and strike a deal with the U.S. as well. First, it was the UAE. The country announced its decision to establish diplomatic ties with Israel in August. In return, Washington provided Abu Dhabi with F-35 fighter jets. Bahrain and Sudan followed suit, with Sudan being removed from the U.S. blacklist of terrorism sponsor countries. White House senior advisor Jared Kushner said a similar deal between Israel and Saudi Arabia could happen soon. For now, it's unclear what the U.S. will give to Riyadh in return for striking a deal with Tel Aviv.
There's a certain set of rules when it comes to the act of war, setting out what can and cannot be done during an armed conflict. And should that law be breached, then the International Criminal Court, or ICC, is tasked with investigating and bringing guilty parties to justice. Yet it seems the court is losing its credibility, as the ICC has recently announced that it intends to abandon its inquiry into British war crimes during the Iraq War, leaving the victims of British atrocities in the country equally abandoned as they seek justice against the British military. However, in spite of the case being dropped, the prosecutor behind the investigation, Fatou Bensouda, has been left in no doubt that the British military committed no end of crimes while stationed in Iraq, leaving many questioning why the ICC would suddenly drop the case.
Yep, but obviously because Britain is one of the permanent five members of the Security Council. And on political grounds, Britain has actually been fairly supportive of the International Criminal Court, even when its close ally and boss, in fact, the US, has fought against it. The British have stood by it, and they've been fairly consistent on it.
So what then are the allegations against the British? Crimes that have said to have been committed include willful killing of innocent civilians, torture of prisoners of war, inhumane and cruel treatment, and rape, all of which are highly illegal under the international rules of conflict and hence constitute as war crimes. The decision by the ICC to drop the case is being blamed on the lack of evidence submitted by the British military, raising the question from Human Rights Watch as to why the UK government has repeatedly shown little interest in investigating the crimes committed by its army. However, the British are no strangers to turning a blind eye to their crimes, as demonstrated through their brutal occupation of states during their imperial days, with the British also having been involved in conflicts in Afghanistan, the north of Ireland, and elsewhere. It remains to be seen as to whether the war crimes seen in Iraq have not been emulated elsewhere, and much like these, left to be forgotten in the past, just like the victims who were subjected to the British crimes. With more and more allegations coming to light of crimes being committed during conflict, from the abuse of Iraqi prisoners by the US and British, to the recent allegations that Australian special forces were involved in the killing of innocent civilians in order to pass initiation tests, it just goes to show how deep the problem really lies. Currently, the World War Crimes Court is also heavily involved in the investigation of US crimes committed during conflict in Iraq and Afghanistan. Yet could the investigation into such crimes be suddenly dropped by the ICC should the US military refuse to cooperate? There does, however, lie a problem in the authority of the ICC, namely that the US has stated that it just does not recognise the court, with the US President Donald Trump stating that the ICC has no jurisdiction over them, something that's been echoed by the Israeli regime, who, much like the US, UK and Australia, are guilty of war crimes and crimes against humanity. Yet with the UK failing to assist the ICC in its investigation, nor having even brought one single prosecution against any of its personnel, how then can the ICC execute justice with no parties interested in cooperating with them or even acknowledging its authority?
Well, it isn't really. I think that the British have actually prosecuted the military for various crimes over the years. Not enough of them. I mean, they've committed many of them over the centuries, whether it was in India or Kenya or, even more recently. But they have prosecuted some. In Northern Ireland, they were prosecuting people. But in this case, they've investigated and they've... Look, I'm not trying to make excuses for them, but from their point of view, they could say that they didn't have enough evidence to meet the burden of a prosecution.
Should the ICC continue to be ignored or see its authority blanked, the question that remains to be asked is whether the body has lost all credibility, and if so, how can the rest of the international community allow the US and its allies to undermine such international bodies as and when it suits them?
Nairobi English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
World leaders aren't doing enough to address the human-caused climate crisis. That seemed to be the main message of United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres' speech at the Climate Ambition Summit 2020, hosted by the UN, the United Kingdom, and France in partnership with Chile and Italy to mark the fifth anniversary of the Paris Agreement. Paris promised to limit temperature rise to as close to 1.5 degrees as possible, but the commitments made in Paris were far from enough to get there. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Jessica Corbett Ryder. This article is published under the heading, "Can anybody still deny that we are facing a dramatic emergency?" asks UN Chief at Climate Summit. Here's the details of this article. World leaders aren't doing enough to address the human-caused climate crisis. That seemed to be the main message of United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres' speech on Saturday, December 2nd, at the Climate Ambition Summit 2020, hosted by the UN, the United Kingdom, and France in partnership with Chile and Italy to mark the fifth anniversary of the Paris Agreement. Paris promised to limit temperature rise to as close to 1.5 degrees as possible, but the commitments made in Paris were far from enough to get there. And even those commitments are not being met, Guterres said. Carbon dioxide levels are at record highs. Today we are 1.2 degrees hotter than before the Industrial Revolution. If we don't change course, we may be headed for a catastrophic temperature rise of more than 3 degrees this century. Can anybody still deny that we are facing a dramatic emergency? He asked. That is why today a call on all leaders worldwide to declare a state of climate emergency in their countries until carbon neutrality is reached. Some 38 countries have already done so, recognizing the urgency and the stakes. I urge all others to follow, he added. Scores of government and business leaders from across the globe joined Saturday's virtual event, December 2nd, which followed the recent release of a series of alarming UN climate reports and came ahead of the UK-hosted COP26 in Glasgow, postponed until next November because of the ongoing coronavirus pandemic. Despite the need for urgent, ambitious action, the dozens of leaders who spoke mostly offered tweaks to existing commitments or promises of bolder moves before crucial talks in Glasgow in late 2021, rather than breakthrough new policies to hasten the end of fossil fuels, Reuters reported. Echoing a key takeaway from Emissions Gap Report 2020, the latest edition of an annual publication from the UN Environment Programme, published recently, Guterres said, "It is unacceptable that governments are giving COVID-19 relief and recovery money to polluters rather than fully committing to setting economies and societies on a green path in line with 2030 Agenda for sustainable development. This is a moral test, he said. Every country, city, financial institution, and company needs to adopt plans to reach net zero emissions by 2050 and start executing them now, including by providing clear short-term targets. Key emitting sectors such as shipping, aviation, and industry must also present and implement now transformational roadmaps in line with this goal. Technology is on our side. Sound economic analysis is our ally. Renewable energy is getting less expensive with every passing day, the UN chief continued. Climate action can be the catalyst for millions of new jobs, better health, and resilient infrastructure. But let us remember that this transition must be just. At the summit, a total of 75 leaders announced 45 renewed pledges to cut emissions, 24 net zero commitments, and 20 adaptation and resilience plans, according to Bloomberg Green. It is not enough, and the clock continues to tick, warned COP26 President Alok Sharma. The choices we make in the year ahead will determine whether we unleash a tidal wave of climate catastrophe on generations to come. While some of the climate action plans put forth by the summit's participants were criticized as not bold enough, the Associated Press noted that some major economies were totally absent from the event. Australia, Brazil, Indonesia, Mexico, Russia, and Saudi Arabia were not at the summit. The Trump administration also declined to participate, but American representatives at the virtual meeting, including Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, Governor Charlie Baker of Massachusetts, and U.S. business leaders such as Apple Chief Executive Tim Cook, according to the AP. Although Donald Trump formally withdrew the United States from the Paris Agreement the day after the November election, other leaders attended the summit. In the midst of the summit, U.S. advocacy groups and progressive politicians issued renewed demands for bold action to address planetary emergency, with some calling for a Green New Deal. The COVID pandemic turned back the clock on emissions worldwide, but it's changed nothing yet about the problem that got us here. Extractive capitalism working in partnership with the white supremacy, patriarchy, and imperialism, heartless road to change everything. We need everyone healthy, valued, and loved. That means now is a super important time, he added. If we return to business as usual post-COVID, it will be a disaster that may be unrecoverable. Climate change needs to be at the heart of every country's recovery plans in 2021.
Around the world with reporters. Brit
Britons woke up to more worrying news this December morning. 1,800, 19,000 fewer workers out of paid employment in November than at the start of the health crisis, meaning coronavirus continues to weigh heavily on the UK labor market.
Is this the direct impact of the pandemic on the UK's labor market?
The problem started before the coronavirus, and the measures being taken are only glossing over the realities. The system is fundamentally flawed. Rich-poor division has got more extreme. The type of jobs coming in are not the old secure, well-paid jobs. They're the insecure, low-paid, temporary jobs.
Released by the Office for National Statistics, the report also says there has been a record rise in redundancies in the 3 months to October, 370,000 of them. Worst hit those in the hospitality sector, teetering during the pandemic. The government says its measures are necessary for beating the virus.
We've put a lot of work in over the past month. There's been enormous sacrifice on everyone's part, and we want to make sure that we continue suppressing the virus. The good news is that we've made improvements, whether it's in mass testing or early promising news on vaccines.
While the prospect of a functioning vaccine has injected some optimism into people's lives, experts say the next few months are likely to remain very challenging.
Do you think more people are going to be out of work in the coming months?
Yes. They will falsify the figures, and they do that by they've done this for years and years, and they massage out of the figures people who are really unemployed.
Add to the mix the immediate impact of a no-deal Brexit, the UK leaving the European Union without a trade deal at the end of this month.
There's also the fact that the unemployment figures don't tell the whole story. There's always a lag in the data. And the government's job retention scheme, also known as the furlough scheme, is propping up the labor market, for now.
In November, the UK Chancellor warned the number of unemployed people in the country was expected to surge to 2.6 million by the middle of next year, and that may be a conservative figure. The fact is that COVID-19 is here to stay, and it'll be months, if not longer, for everyone to be vaccinated. The unforgiving equation is that the tighter the measures to protect lives, the more devastating the impact on livelihoods. Saeed Pariza, London.
Italy's petrol station operators have been staging a strike since Monday to demand the Italian government being included among the recipients of support measures to mitigate the nefarious impact of the anti-COVID restrictions. It is the latest in a string of petrol station strikes over market conditions and aid measures during the pandemic emergency. In late November, another three-day strike had been called by sector unions and organizations and staged on the country's motorways.
Petrol retailers' associations complained that gas stations suffered losses amounting to 90% of their revenues on Italy's motorways and about 60% of the income in urban areas during the lockdown. They say it is no longer possible to meet overheads and fixed costs in the current situation.
Small and very small petrol station operators have been excluded from receiving aid payments from the government because all petrol stations remained open during the lockdown. Considering the cancellation of sales due to COVID and restrictions, we are at risk of no longer being able to guarantee the opening of stations with continuity and regularity.
Last month, the Italian government issued a package of aid for the businesses and families most affected by the new anti-COVID restrictions. As many as 211,000 companies have received support funds totaling over 960 million euros.
There's no doubt that support measures to businesses and families have helped a bit. Having said that, the situation remains critical for many, unfortunately.
New talks between the government and retail groups are likely to be held in the coming days. Petrol station operators are slated to end their strike on Thursday. Max Civili, Rome.
A debate in the European Parliament has heard that the EU is far too dependent on the United States dollar, and there's a serious lack of political will when it comes to negating the effects of US sanctions.
The recent American economic sanctions against Russia, Iran, and Cuba, especially the extraterritorial effects, should be responded from our side. We need an efficient instrument to counteract these illegal sanctions.
Big firms such as Airbus, Peugeot, and Citroen want to do business with countries like Iran, but are being told by the Trump administration that if they do, they will not be able to trade with the United States.
In relation to Iran, the Commission is supportive of the instrument in support of trade exchanges, INSTEX, an initiative of three countries initially, Germany, France, and the United Kingdom, and more recently joined by Belgium, Denmark, the Netherlands, Norway, Finland, and Sweden.
However, many lawmakers say that EU instruments designed to bypass US sanctions, such as the aforementioned INSTEX, and also the so-called blocking statute, are dysfunctional.
Some analysts argue that European Union foreign policy has been very negatively influenced in recent years by Washington, and that ultimately it is ordinary, hard-working EU citizens who are paying the price for that.
This is because millions of additional jobs could be created if the EU more effectively counteracted US sanctions. Countries like Iran, Russia, and Cuba represent huge markets.
It does not only affect EU businesses, but also puts into question the political independence and ultimately the sovereignty of the EU and its member states.
Apparently, hypocrisy is rife. For example, the EU and US shy away from imposing sanctions on Israel and Saudi Arabia, despite the atrocities these regimes commit against civilians in Palestine and Yemen.
It's a fight for global domination of the West, led by the United States of America, but unfortunately, in this fight, they stamp over the very same rules they proclaimed they are struggling for.
And he has lost on the merits.
EU lawmakers have expressed hope that the Joe Biden administration will be less aggressive with respect to sanctions. However, they are calling on the EU to quickly develop policies to try and deliver strategic autonomy for the bloc. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Israel's municipality in Jerusalem, Al-Quds, has approved the building of 8,300 new settler units. According to Israeli media, the settler units are set to be constructed for residential, industrial, and commercial purposes. The new settler units will be built on lands from Beit Safafa, Malha, and Al-Baqa villages in Al-Quds, and all the way to Al-Walaj village, northwest of Beit Lahem in the occupied West Bank. Experts say the construction is scheduled to begin by 2021, and work will continue until 2040.
It's a long-term colonial project that goes until 2040. This is located mainly on the both sides of the Green Line from the south of the Jerusalem, an area called Tel Aviv. It's taking what has been left from Beit Safafa village, Palestinian village there, and to connect also the settlements, the blocks of the settlements with the south of Jerusalem, what we called it Greater Jewish Jerusalem, that reach up to Gush Etzion, about 40 kilometers south of Jerusalem.
In addition to the new settlement units, Israel revealed earlier new projects, including building dozens of roads between settlements through a master plan, the first of its kind in years, to establish a transportation network in the settlements. The Palestinian National Bureau for Defending Land and Resisting Settlements accused Israel of expanding the settlements in the West Bank by constructing new roads. They say the move is a clear indication that Israel carries on with its plan to annex large parts of the occupied West Bank.
It's part of a larger plan of colonization. The Israeli occupation is racing against time to change the demography of the region. It is seeking to achieve its project, known as Greater Jerusalem, by 2040. Israel plans to establish a state for settlers inside the Palestinian state.
Observers say through settlement expansion, Israel is looking to ensure that within the next decade, 1 million Jewish settlers will live in the occupied West Bank. Today, there are about 500,000 Israeli settlers in the West Bank, with almost 250,000 more living in Jerusalem, Al-Quds. Palestinians say all indications prove that Israel is racing against time to build a new settlement before the outgoing U.S. administration leaves office. The Palestinian Authority has warned that settlement activity has grave consequences in the occupied West Bank and will definitely lead to